placed little boxes in a row.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your fully tattooed lower left calf of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Can't you see I'm doing fine? It's what I've always wanted. Two little kids out on the lawn. Once we had love, now it's gone. Good things haven't happened yet. I'm empty as a movie set. It's what I've always wanted. Hey, here's to you, California.
That was California by Blink-182. California is about a state that I don't relate to, but a state of mind that we all relate to. And that state of mind is pop punk in adulthood. And I am here with some punk papas. That's real talk. I've got Rob Harville from The Ringer.
Hello.
I've got Joe Coscarelli, who is not a papa, but he is a big papa.
That's me.
Our music reporter at the New York Times. And we're here to talk about the reemergence of pop punk as a thing that we might conceivably talk about on the New York Times podcast, which is just not a thing that we could have called 6 months ago. Blink-182 has a new album out. It's called California.
Put some respect on that. The number one album in the country.
Knock Drake off the top.
Yeah, okay. Well, you have some things to answer for, Rob. First of all, Rob wrote about the Blink-182 album, as I did, and in Rob's review, which you should read because it's beautifully written, but there is a sentence somewhere near the end of that review where you're like, this record is better than Views.
Oh, it's definitely better than Views. You got to be kidding me.
Oh, my God. Hashtag Brexit.
One thing, it is half as long, like 60% as long.
Yeah, it's still twice as long as it should be, right? To be fair.
Well, yeah, sure, but we're talking relatively. Like, Views is like 4 hours long.
That's true.
Like, I never want to hear Drake's voice
again. It's like a Terrence Malick film.
Yeah, it's like an HBO like miniseries event.
Rob, when your child gets married, One Dance is not allowed on the playlist, but the one about the pool.
Yeah,
that's my kid's wedding, if at all possible.
Do you like the Blink-182 record because it's a record that speaks a language that your children speak?
I think my children are a little more coherent at this point. At 5 and 2 years old, you know, like their interests are more in line with mine. You're a Drake Views person.
I agree that Views is not Drake's best work, but it's hard for me to reasonably listen to this Blink-182 record and be like, well, this is better than Views. Okay, but we can table that for now. Let's talk about what's on this Blink-182 record. This is a record that is ostensibly it's the second attempt that they've made as a group to move towards adulthood. Talk to me, Rob, about the last attempt that they made.
Yeah, I went back to Neighborhoods, I think it was 2011. And I remember really liking it at the time, and I was sort of bummed out when I went and revisited it now. And like, there's a couple songs that sing out to me, and the rest of it.
Did you also say that that was better than Take Care in 2011?
No, I would never say that, John. Jeez.
Just checking.
Come on.
Just checking.
Was it Tom DeLonge had that side project, Angels and Airwaves, which was like an extremely explicit, like U2, like Coldplay sort of rip. Like, I think I saw him at the Bowery Ballroom, and I was like, what the hell is going on here? Like, that's definitely what they were going for on that record. Yeah. Like, they were going to be an arena rock band, you know, and it just didn't come off at all.
With mood. So much mood.
And literally not a thing any person has ever asked of Blink-182.
Exactly,
like, whoever was like, I really want Mark Hoppus to be my Bono.
But they've had so, you know, when you go back to Adam's Song, you go back to I Miss You, like, people love that.
Stay Together for the Kids, yeah.
Right, but it's good when there's one per album. Right?
Exactly,
two
right,
max.
And a whole album of that is, yeah. And so Neighborhoods did not age very well for me. And so this is in the same way that sort of Weezer returned to like their roots, you know, their very simple pop punk sort of songs about California girls sort of thing. Like, yeah, this is their return that's sort of marred by the fact that now, you know, they've got lineup issues and you have to figure out if like that chemistry is not replaceable.
Issues really the right word? Because like, you know, Tom DeLonge was replaced by Matt Skiba, who was formerly of Alkaline, like, is Alkaline Trio still a thing?
Good question. They'll be back.
I feel like I looked that up on the internet and didn't come up with a good answer before I wrote that. But Alkaline Trio, a group that I care very little for, even when I was going out of my way to pay attention, you know, in whatever time period.
I'll ride for From Here to the Infirmary. I was a child when it came out, as I was with most of these albums. But like the disclaimer over this whole podcast should be that I was 13 when Blink-182
in
was
Florida.
At their peak.
In Florida.
And I was
in
living in Florida.
Yeah, so, right. Your hall pass.
All of my opinions are marred by
asterisk.
Yes. That's terrifying.
Fully asterisk. So this album, East California, attempts a different thing vis-a-vis maturity.
Right.
Basically, they return to sort of the scene of the crime musically.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, most of the songs are sad, or most of the songs are about exhaustion or let down or disappointment. This is something that I was really struck by, because the two skits that you wrote about at the beginning and the end of your piece, skits, and obviously are very striking and feel very vintage Blink skits. They're 20 seconds long. They are puerile. They're terrible prepubescent child sex humor. But in between, there's a bunch of songs about how punk rock saved lives and about girls who let you down, and but like not in the kind of whiny way, in the actual melancholy way that I, as a middle-aged person, feel in my day-to-day life. Does Blink wear that well, though, in your mind?
I think they can. As Joe said, I think that those songs work better as like one or two in the midst of like a more puerile and, you know, and youthful kind of thing. And now that they're having to do that all the time, like I think that it's going to diminish the impact. But like that song San Diego, I'm really struck by. I think it's near the end. It's like, I don't want it. Please don't make me go back to San Diego. You know, like that's a pretty explicit sort of message, you know, that they're coming full circle and they sort of realize that they're all in what? They're all over 40 at this point, maybe close to 45. All... it's this is not a band designed to age, like very much by design. And like it's you know, it's interesting to watch them confront that even if they don't succeed, you know, in surmounting it.
They also had no really obvious place to go. I mean, you look at Green Day, and Green Day, number one, had a more explicit or at least not obfuscated political text early in their career. So then when Green Day got serious and got political and then went to Broadway and got overblown, at least you can trace that directly back to the early 90s. With Blink, I mean, it's you know, you have the sense in your piece where you're like, there's a band who basically decided that having an erection was a thought worth expounding upon, or like an intellectual approach worth expounding upon.
Yeah.
That just doesn't mean anything when you're in your 40s.
Well, the startling thing was that they were always old, though. Like,
that's
peak
true.
Blink 182, you know, What's My Age Again, Blink 182. Like, Mark Hoppus was almost 30 years old singing about high school and middle school, like in a pretty for high schoolers and middle schoolers. Like, this was always part of their game.
Yeah.
But you can't keep playing it into your 40s.
Exactly. Like, you read old cover stories, interviews with Blink 182, and it's like, this is what we did instead of go to college. Like, this arrested our development in a very explicit way that, like, we're running with. Like, that's our whole shtick, is that we never grew up. And, like, now that they have, like, they couldn't help themselves. And it's,
Is it meaningful at all that they have the number one record in the country, you think?
It's confounding. I mean, I don't know who, you know, these numbers are not, they're not number one based on streams. They're number one based on people buying this album. Maybe not the physical version. Maybe they're downloading it off of iTunes for, you know, the $12 or $15. But that's still, it's startling. 120,000 people in this country bought the entire Blink 182 album. And they didn't want to listen to it on Spotify. They wanted to own it in some way. And I don't know who those people are.
What's the average age?
I think it's teenagers again, right?
Really?
I think it's still teenagers.
That'd
I don't think
shocking,
it's a nostalgia
I don't
thing.
Think. I think it's old
but
folks.
But if you see them, I saw them, you know, a few years ago, they played Jones Beach. Mm-hmm. It was teenagers. That's who was there. In which case, and again, I don't have the demographic breakdown on it, but if it's true that at least a large section of this buying population are, you know, under 18 or whatever, then it's truly amazing that they were able to appeal to the same fan base 20 years apart. Like, can you think of another act that didn't graduate into a nostalgia act but appealed to the same...
Aerosmith?
Yeah, like, maybe.
Alcoholics through the years.
Yeah, there we go. Disregard,
But like, who, like, that's, so you think it's a nostalgia thing? You think people who grew up on Blink are the ones who bought this album?
I think people who have those lower calf tattoos, like, paired with, like, a pair of flip-flops that's just corroded with sweat. Like, I think it's those people who are, like, in their 40s who are like, rah, Blink, brah.
I mean, Blink stands, get at us. Tell us who you are, please.
Yeah.
Like,
I can't imagine being
actually,
a teenager.
Get at Joe. Don't get at me. Don't get at me. Don't
I can't imagine being a teenager listening to this record, like what this record has for you if you are 18, you know, because it's all, as you say, it's all about regret and aging and all of those kind of things like that. You don't want to hear that if you're a teenager,
although,
I'm assuming.
But there are moments like that, and this is where I think it's worth sort of splitting Blink into its constituent parts.
Yeah.
There are moments where Travis Barker really takes over this record.
Right.
And you're like, oh, this is like an incredibly agile drummer. This is a drummer who has a real sense, both of rock music and also non-rock music.
And
like,
he's always been
plays hip hop. Yeah, there were moments in this record where I was really getting bummed out by Hoppus and Skiba, and then Barker would show up, and I'd be like, "Oh, okay, I can be here. Like, yeah. I'm allowed to be here. I want to be here." I don't know. Like, when I hear Mark's voice, and this is something I was thinking a lot about in listening to this record, even when he's singing the most depressing stuff, there's that tone.
Right.
It's like, it sounds like Rob, you have children. Like, I imagine it sounds like one of your children.
The brattiness.
Yeah, like, yeah. When they're asking for something, like, you probably hear, you probably
there
hear Mark Hoppus.
The nasal nowadays. Brattiness. Yeah.
Okay.
Mark sucks. I know. Like, you know, like, I'm sure that, like, when your kids are asking you, that's, yeah. Like, that's probably what
but
pops up.
But speaking of that voice, eerie. Like, how much do we miss Tom on this album? Like, me, I was not a huge Blink guy ever, but always leaned toward Mark songs.
Yeah,
but
me too.
But Tom was a counterpoint. Yep. You know, you had to have both.
Well, I think the problem is Skiba treats punk as, like, sort of an intellectual exercise, and I don't think anybody else in Blink-182 ever has. So there are moments when he shows up, and I'm like, oh, wow, you're really taking this serious.
He's a little
dog.
Heady for...
Yeah,
for
and I'm like, this is, like, you picked the wrong room. Like, you picked the wrong... Like you right. showed up at the convention center, and you, like, went to the wrong banquet. And now you're just sort of stuck.
But maybe that's what 40-something Hoppus... wanted. Maybe that's why he was drawn
or
to,
maybe all
to this
the
guy.
Roadies who would otherwise have filled Tom DeLonge's chair like have moved on to other bands or like they're just, you know, they're on a Warped Tour right now. You know, Skib is also a guy who's been, hasn't he been sort of a hired gun in the past?
I think he's popped up on some tours and
so whatnot. I do think it's like you need someone who like basically is willing to table the large portion of their own interests and like short of like Metallica getting what's the dude's name who replaced Newsted?
Right. Yeah, I don't remember. That guy. I love that
That
movie.
Guy.
That guy.
Yeah, that guy.
That very popular
who is one
guy.
One quarter of the Metallica Corporation right yeah. now. Great scene in that documentary. But, you know, short of that guy who, like, was already a hired gun in some other band, sure. basically.
Green Day has one, too. They added,
oh, do they?
Know, their guitar player.
Oh, is that
like
right?
The fourth member of
really?
Green Day. Yeah.
There you go.
I think it's going to hurt Blink live because I think about Blink-182, like they'll play a very serious song like Adam's Song and then it'll end and then like they'll totally undercut whatever they just did.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to guess that like Skiba can't do that.
I don't think he
to
wants
the same
to.
Degree. Right.
Yeah.
And so like that's the dynamic. That's what it's always
and they
meant
leaned
to me.
On that so much. I
right.
mean their live album
right.
is like
yeah,
entirely
it's like banter.
Banter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like a comedy record.
Yeah.
For
yeah.
Sure. To circle back to the fact that it's number one record in the country, do you think that bespeaks an actual latent appetite for this stuff that maybe has been seeded by the quiet return of pop punk and emo over the last 2 or 3 years? Or do you think it's purely like Blink as a name you trust?
I want to think it's the first one, but I think it's the latter.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you think about the pop punk, you can't get past a certain level of success with pop punk. Like you look at like Fall Out Boy,
mm-hmm.
who has now become an arena rock band who will collaborate with anyone at any time for any reason. Like Fall Out Boy is on the Ghostbusters soundtrack with
rappers,
Missy Elliott,
songwriters,
and it's terrible. But
yarf,
but yeah, it's
yarf. Yeah, they'll do anything.
Yeah, so yeah. They had to leave pop punk behind essentially to get to where they are, and the fact that Blink didn't have to do that is certainly heartening. But yeah, I'm guessing it's just the institution that they're just one of those bands that is way more influential. You know, and way more successful than you realize. Like, they disappear for long periods and you forget, like, how influential they are and how they used to be on, like, the VMAs and stuff like that. And they used to rub shoulders with, like, all
the
big
Backstreet
people.
Boys.
The Backstreet
Boys.
Exactly.
They were there.
Yeah,
they were on TRL alongside
right,
Britney
exactly.
yeah. and the boy band. So.
And they were, and it's, let's not sort of downplay how radical that was. Because when Blink-182 was doing those parody videos that basically inserted them into the mainstream conversation,
right.
it was still radical to have a band with guitars mm-hmm. on a TRL. Like, that wasn't a thing. Like, you know, people downplay yeah. TRL, but TRL was sort of, like, peak 2000s teen pop. Like, that was the, you know, if there was a One Direction, that's where the One Direction would have been at that right. day. You know, like, all that stuff. Blink-182 always felt, I mean, they felt like schmucks, but they felt like schmucks who would game the system.
Yeah.
I think right now, they only really made sense at that time in the framework of storming the gates.
Yeah.
And now there's no gates.
But there was an aspect of them that was always not that different from the boy bands, except that they had guitars. You know, they had guys who were attractive, you know, to a certain demographic, calf tattoos,
yeah.
whatever.
Hey.
But and they had hooks, you know what I mean? Like these were catchy songs. These were top 10 hits, you know? Like, so you think of someone like 5 Seconds of Summer, like
I was
basically
ask,
the same as what Blink was doing then.
What's the overlap with 5 Seconds of Summer?
Yeah, and it's worth mentioning. We probably could have done this next week because, amusingly enough, Madison Square Garden, the next two nights, not tonight, we're recording this on Wednesday, but tomorrow night, Thursday, brand new.
With Modest Mouse.
With Modest Mouse. That's right.
Friday night, 5 Seconds of Summer.
Holy moly.
Yeah, that's a sweet spot right there.
I'll see you there.
Yeah, Punk Ain't Dead.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm wearing Vans. That's how you know, like, that's, I haven't worn Vans in years. So, you know, it's back. I'll never get you out of my mind. It keeps me awake and it keeps me alive. Now that you finally figured me out, I can go on and rest easier now. So what's left to lose? Now that I got nothing, you're having your doubts. Pack all your bags and move them all out. Now that I got nothing, you're having doubts. What am I supposed to do now? And pop punk lives. It thrives.
Never left.
It mutates. That was Pup, an excellently named Canadian band that makes pop punk. I'm not even sure if they would say they make pop punk, but they do, whether you guys like it or not.
What do you think they'd say they'd make?
It's a good question.
Tropical House.
Yeah, exactly. They're working with Robin Schulz right now. That song is called Doubts. It's from their second album, which came out a couple months ago. It's called The Dream Is Over. And Pup, to me, seems like one of the bands that's either knowingly or not kind of carrying on the musical mantle. Maybe not the subject matter mantle of Blink-182, but the musical mantle of Blink-182. Yeah. You think of bands like them or the Menzingers and that structural stuff that's kind of, you know, I sort of made a joke in my piece where I was basically like, the Blink-182 records, old ones, are like Brill Building records. And they are kind of like they're that square. Like if you strip away the sort of like the bad fashion, they're basically that square. And Pup feels very much like it's moving in that space. But listening to this record and also that band's previous record made me think, well, okay, what's the legacy of the mainstream pop punk of the early 2000s? And I wonder, is it sort of second or third wave bands like this? Or is it a thing that we've all talked about in various ways? Is it sort of your emo revival 7.0 that we're currently in the midst of?
I think it could go either way. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a matter of how sensitive you want to be perceived as. You know, like Pup is a band, like they're really juvenile and they sort of scream at you, but then it turns out that they have very tender songs about like their iguanas, you know, and in their childhood and things like that. Or you could do like the Hotelier or Modern Baseball, or those emo bands doing like, you're not very funny most of the time. The Hotelier aren't funny at all. Like Modern Baseball are actually pretty juvenile when they want to be, but like there's a sensitivity there and like there's an emotional, that's the context, not the subtext, like that's what they're trying to do, whereas Pup sort of sneaks that stuff in, you know, under a sheen of, you know, just being juvenile.
Yeah, I mean, certainly a difference between, at least in live shows, you know, you go to a Pup live show and it's very it's real rowdy, it's real raucous,
right?
And you go to a, you were at a Hotelier live show, and I'm sure
I was caught a bunch of Pokemon, by the way.
As
did 20 to 40% of the crowd.
Which one did you get, man?
I don't know their names, John.
Got that Zubat?
Yeah. No Charizards.
Oh man,
Insight.
You can't come back on the podcast until you got Charizard.
Central Park.
Just FYI,
it's fine.
But tell me about that Hotelier show. Was it real spastic or was it felt?
It was extremely felt.
Yeah. It's more arms around the shoulders.
It is extremely,
It's more singing to your friends, I think, in my experience.
I don't know. I don't have friends, it's tough.
It was one of those things. I hadn't seen this in a long time. Like, a mosh pit started, and immediately the dude from the stage was like, no. Yeah. Like, incorporated into the lyrics, like, stop that. Amazing. And, like, it was a very compact, tight, like, hot room on, like, a Sunday night, and everyone was sort of mashed together. And so it totally made sense for him to do sort of the Fugazi thing of, like, please don't do that or you're going to kill yourselves or me.
Right.
You know, but it was very heartfelt. Whereas I saw Modern Baseball a couple months ago, and first of all, I'm in my late 30s. Like, I was the oldest person there by 15 years.
Salute that man.
I felt like a junior high dance chaperone.
Feel old at Modern Baseball shows.
Yeah, I have never felt more uncomfortable in my life than at a Modern Baseball show. And I think those guys are actually closest to the Blink dynamic that we talked about. Like, they stop playing like a very heartfelt song, and they're jabbering with each other, and it's two very distinct personalities, and like they're developing their own stories, you know, through their songs and through like the interviews they've been doing lately.
It's interesting, though, because they don't relate to Blink.
Not really. No.
Having, you know, having interviewed them, like, they love Green Day, you know, mm-hmm. more than Blink, but they love the Metzingers more than anything, you know. And yeah. what they said explicitly to me was that they got into this kind of music from bands that got into it from Blink 182.
Right.
So that's how many steps removed we are. You know, they had to go backwards.
How hard did you have to? How hard did you have to try to keep a straight face during that part of the conversation?
I mean, it's real though. It's real.
Of course, it's real.
Like to them, Green Day, that's oldies. So I think there's just not that. There's not that level of playfulness in bands that are still doing it these days. I think in part because for you to still be making pop punk or emo, like, you have to really love it. Like, it's not a goof anymore. If you want a goof, you'll make a rap song on Pro Tools or whatever. Right. Like, I think you're not going to start a guitar band shouts if you're in
white,
it for jokes.
Shouts to white privilege, though, because that's a real thing.
But I think that's real.
Yeah, that's
my favorite pop punk emo band ever, Say Anything, who I think are a big Modern Baseball people. Like, the first time I saw Modern Baseball, they were touring with them, and they said, like,
love Say Anything.
This is the reason we got into music, with Say Anything. And that's like, that's an extremely serious, like, solipsistic record about, like, his mental issues and stuff like that. And it's extremely juvenile and puerile and, like, kind of misogynist, frankly, in very identifiable ways. But, like, that's a very specific kind of thing. And, like, that's a true believer, like, cult kind of thing. And I think that a lot of the pop punk and emo bands now are going that route. Like,
yeah, I mean, Say
serious.
Anything's breakthrough was a concept album about the Holocaust.
Yeah,
about his
basically.
Grandparents in the Holocaust.
Calling like, out their ex-girlfriends by name and all
that's
that.
That's a
kind of
Hotelier
thing.
Right. thing. That's a Modern Baseball thing. Like, I think we're seeing, and Brand New, I think, fits in right. there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, these are people who listened to a lot of Morrissey when they were kids. You know, there's more gravitas to it than your average Blink fan or band, I think, in their lineage.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that Is a Real Boy by Say Anything is my favorite emo record of all time is I remember exactly where I was when I bought it.
I bought it in
the mid-2000s at Tower Records when they were going out of business and, like, every CD was $5 or less. That's, and this is the real
gold mine times.
So this is pre-streaming era, and so that was a really good deal. And so I went to the Lincoln Center Tower Records, and I was wandering around, and I bought a bunch of records, including that one. And I also saw John Caramonica, soon to be of the New York Times, standing in the hip hop aisle with, I would estimate, 25 CDs per arm. Like, you had them, like, stacked up very precariously.
Hell yeah.
And you looked at me like, oh my God, he caught me. Like, you almost, like, threw them down and ran.
But you were
the
one with the Say Anything.
But I was the one with the Say Anything. I was the dignified person in that exchange.
I'm certain that that was 20. Amazing. I'm certain that was 50 CDs of heat, of pure heat. Pure.
It's made you the man you are today.
True story.
Yes.
Why do we feel like the last 3 or 4 years have basically become a hotbed of kind of emo 5.0? Like, why is that happening now? And I think a lot about the Warped Tour. Mm-hmm. The Warped Tour, you would have thought, would have been like the prime place where emo would go to kind of like multiply and fester and grow like barnacles. But Warped Tour, certainly when I was covering, I haven't covered the last couple of years, but when I was covering it, like, say, 09 to 13 or 14, what you ended up having was a lot of metalcore, a lot of post-hardcore, a lot of melodic hardcore, and then a couple of years of, like, basically, like, spastic electropunk dudes who look like V-Files kids dress now, like, making weird, like, rap punk songs.
Yikes.
And that was this, it was awful. It was really horrifying. If Warped Tour knew what was good for it, this is actually where the new wave of emo bands would be, like, cutting their teeth. And I couldn't figure out, has emo become so sort of distanced from its quote-unquote punk origins that it's not valid in a space like that? Like, is that just, like, weirdly reflective of Warped Tour having basically very masculine taste?
The way that I see it, and I talk to the Modern Baseball guys about this and sort of the people around their Philly scene, is...
They ever play Warp?
No, I don't think so. Maybe a couple of dates, but I don't think they were ever.
They were not like
on
the tour, right? Yeah.
You know, so you have Green Day and Blink, then you get Good Charlotte, then you get Fall Out Boy, and then you get Panic at the Disco, right? And Fall Out Boy and Panic at the Disco sort of become pop groups. You know, they're taken by Top 40, and it's not dissimilar to, you know, Hillary Clinton taking Bernie's. Parts from Bernie's campaign.
Holy moly.
It's the very rare center pulling in parts from the left.
Super, wow.
Work with me here. Just roll with
Keep
it.
Going.
Just roll
Keep
with
going.
It.
Oh
So then it becomes pop music. So then these, you know, then you get a couple years of bands that are, you know, essentially boy bands with guitars playing music that sounds something like Fall Out Boy or Good Charlotte, and it's on the charts, and you get, you know, your all-time lows and the bands that headlined Warped Tour in this fallow period. And I think that sort of killed the DIY version of this stuff, the smaller, more punk, more local scene, because it had been... It had been commercialized in such a way. And then it takes a while for that to start bubbling back up from the underground, I think, when it's become so big at the top.
So because of that, and you also think because of that, the stripe that the underground basically sort of turned towards was your sort of like your top shelf records type stuff, like things that basically were taking the parts of pop punk slash emo from 10 years ago that did not become the overly commercialized parts and basically reseeded it.
That's how I see it. Mm-mm.
And I think in the end, it's just there are four or five great bands that come from different places and you just retrofit a scene onto them. So you get into it over it and that's great. You get the Hotelier, you get The World is a Beautiful Place, and I'm No Longer Afraid to Die. Like, those people probably didn't know each other when they were starting out.
Tweab full of,
And so, and then you say, okay, this is an emo revival. Clearly, this was
Wonder Years.
The Wonder Years, exactly. And so it's they didn't set out planning to do this, but there were just enough people doing it individually on their own that it sort of coalesces into this thing that you then have to retroactively explain as like, yeah, emo came back because of this and this. Yeah.
Does emo at this moment have the potential to be something other than a basically post-pop punk breakthrough rejoinder? Is it doomed or relegated, permanently relegated to counter status?
So are you saying, are we going to get another Fall Out Boy? Is
another,
one of
or
these
another
groups
or another
become...
Dashboard Confessional even?
Or My Chemical Romance?
Yeah, I mean that's like the sleeper. Yeah, it's a sleeper band in that. I mean, not as a band, but in terms of like taking that template and turning it into. I mean, My Chemical Romance are like the Panic at the Disco of emo.
Right. Yeah.
That sounded really mean to My Chemical
Romance.
That
did, actually. Plus, when you combine that with the Hillary and
and also,
thing, I'm super confused.
And also it was mean to Kay, who is my predecessor in this job. Hi, Kay. Sorry, I don't like My Chemical Romance as much as you do. I'm sorry. But, you know, they basically took the theatrical route through that.
I think these bands today that are doing well in what we from our office chairs might call the emo revival, I think they're wary of...
I don't even have a chair.
Nobody wants to be emo ever.
But I think they're wary of, even more so of becoming the pop version of that to get... They don't want to be plucked from the underground and put in all the car commercials.
Right.
But you also no longer have to do that. I mean, this is something that's true across genre. I mean, there was a much more obvious arc of like mainstream co-optation of underground or independent scenes. That was like a much more like Das Kapital, like, you know, it followed an expected path as recently as I want to say 5 or 6 years ago. But the last 4 or 5 years with the flattening that comes with the internet and basically this kind of acceptance that we can self-sustain based off of internet fandom, that's less likely to happen. Maybe that's why you don't get a new Blink-182. The old Blink-182 is still Blink-182, and none of these new bands really occupy that space because that space isn't a relevant one to them.
I think the path is more the Brand New path. You know, Brand New is playing Madison Square Garden, as you said, with, you know, and they have the help of Modest Mouse. They're co-headlining, I think. But Brand New never had a big album, never had a big song. Like, they had some music videos on Fuse. Remember Fuse? But they never crossed over.
Shouts to Maria Sherman, though. Like, we can't have this conversation without giving a shout-out to Maria Sherman.
True, absolutely.
Shouts to Maria Sherman.
So they never crossed over in the way that a Blink did. And I think that maybe that's the path. We'll continue to see these bands doing healthy numbers, selling out a lot of shows, touring a lot, and making their money that way.
When you talk to Modern Baseball and they talk to you about what they imagined their career was going to look like, what did they tell you?
They're just happy to pay their rent, and they live in Philly, so it's cheap. You know, they sell out shows across the country, and they could have never imagined, I think, that they would be able to do that. And I don't think they would scoff at an offer to have their song in a movie trailer. Like, you know, teen movies, I think, should be tapping these bands more often than they are. Yeah. And I think there's money to be made there. But I don't think they would ever think that they could have a song on the Hot 100.
Right.
And I don't imagine that happening.
Mm-hmm.
The brand new Modest Mouse thing is interesting to me. It's like those bands were so far apart 5, 10 years ago. Like their fans, there would be no Venn diagram fan overlap between them at all. But they're all sort of just coalescing into indie rock now, which is a very strange thing. The idea that like emo will become indie rock now that indie rock supposedly is not a big thing anymore.
Right, but that just, it also underscores how the wars that defined, at least for me and you, Rob, defined our musical upbringing.
Right.
Are not only less relevant as you get older, but less relevant as the internet does its work. They're not fights anymore.
And you see that with Death Cab as well, I think. Like Death Cab is in that same bucket with Brand New and Modest Mouse and any number of these bands that were pretty big when The OC was a television show.
It's just mopey white dudes. Yeah. That's it. And that's a thing. That's the real emo.
That will forever be a thing.
It's a big umbrella.
It's a real emo. All right, so let's close out with some real mopey white dudes. Modern Baseball, Just Another Face. Thank you for joining us this week on the New York Times Popcast. Thank you to my guests, Joe Coscarelli and Rob Harvilla of The Ringer. You can read Joe on Modern Baseball, myself on Blink-182 at nytimes.com/music, and Rob on Blink-182 at theringer.com. You can listen to this podcast and every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and we'll be back next week.